cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klinger, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we're going to be reading a couple of selections from Elmer Kelton's Wild West. If we have time, we may include a selection from a book we've read before, a very thin volume entitled Western Short Story Showcase, Volume 1. Throughout his lengthy career, Elmer Kelton authored numerous Western short stories and novels and won many accolades and awards. Our first story is entitled Colt Size. As dusk closed in, Tom Binford glanced at the little boy huddled beside him on the springy buckboard seat. A trace of tears shone in the kid's eyes again. "We'll be home pretty quick, Danny," Tom said tenderly. "Your granddad'll be glad to see you, and there's a mighty pretty girl who'll fix a warm supper for us." Looking down at the child's freckled face, Tom remembered the boy's mother, pretty Laura Summers. Tom had once thought he loved her when he was a cowboy on her father's ranch. But that was before Barney Driscoll had swept her off her feet and talked her into eloping with him. Only after the marriage had Laura realized Driscoll had wanted nothing but her inheritance. Driscoll, though, had defeated his own purpose. After 6 years of living with his drunken cruelty and hatred, Laura had died. She'd left Driscoll nothing but a 4-year-old son whom he didn't want. Now, 2 years later, the boy's grandfather lay dying. Old Frank Summers had been smashed up by a runaway team which had wrecked his wagon on the crooked road that led to Rocky Wells. Feebly, he had asked Tom Binford to find his grandson and bring the lad to him. After 2 weeks of following Driscoll's sign from one West Texas town to another, from saloon to saloon, Tom had found the boy, hungry and lonely, shut in a dingy room above a rank-smelling bar. Angrily, Tom had led the youngster down to where his father was sitting on the losing end of a poker game. Eyes blazing, Driscoll had risen drunkenly and slapped the youngster across the face. "I told you to stay in your room," he snarled. "Now get up there." Blinding anger had run through Tom, and he had piled into Driscoll, swinging, pounding, smashing. Then he had stood swaying over the half-conscious man, his bruised fists clenched. "You're not fit to have a son," he had said. "I'm taking this boy back to his granddad, and if you ever come after him, I'll kill you." Maybe Tom hadn't realized then what he had said, but he knew now. When old Frank died, the boy would inherit the ranch, and Barney Driscoll would be sure to try to take it for himself. In the darkness that gathered ahead, Tom could see the ranch. A warmth rose in him as he thought of the way Della Graham would smile when the buckboard pulled in. Maybe she had finished her wedding dress while he had been gone. But a doubt tugged at him as he considered her reaction to Danny. What would she think about their starting life together with a 6-year-old foster son who belonged to neither of them, particularly when she remembered that Danny was the son of a woman Tom had once hoped to marry? His heart was beating faster when he pulled up at the kitchen door of the frame ranch house. Della Graham stepped out, her blonde hair shining like gold in the yellow light of the lamp behind her. Tom climbed down off the buckboard and kissed her warmly. "How's Frank?" he asked her then. "I've got his grandson here." Della sadly shook her head. "You're too late, Tom. He wanted to hold out till you got back, but he died a few hours ago." Tom couldn't say anything. Della reached for the frightened boy. "Come on, fellow," she said tenderly. "We'll take care of you till your daddy comes to get you." Quickly, Tom found his voice. "His dad won't ever get him again. We're keeping him." Della looked at him, her eyes wide with surprise. Tom carefully lifted Danny down, heat roiling within him. "See those bruises on his face? See how he trembles when you speak to him? You think I'll ever let him go back to a dad who'd treat him like that?" Della's lips moved, but she said nothing. Still burning inside, Tom tried vainly to read what was in her eyes. Finally, she spoke again. "Then you'll likely have to fight, Tom. Old Frank told us he was leaving everything to this boy. You think the father won't try to get Danny back? In the days that followed the funeral, Danny seemed to lose his fear. He followed Tom and Della's father, the retiring foreman, all over the ranch. He was interested in everything he found. The doggy calves in the milk pen, the half-wild cats that stayed in the barn, the chickens Della kept to furnish eggs for the ranch. Tom grinned when he saw the youngster shine up his new brass-toed boots, or spied him proudly watching his shadow as he rode along on the paint pony Tom had given him. But Tom always watched the road from town, watched for Barney Driscoll, and he worried about Della. Though her father was about ready to leave the foreman's job to Tom and move to his own little ranch, Della hadn't said a word lately about the wedding. What if she didn't want to keep the boy? The small ranch crew was having its noon meal one day when a buckboard came rattling up in front of the house. A moment later, Big Sheriff Will Yarby stepped through the door. "Howdy, folks," he greeted pleasantly. "Sorry to bust up your dinner, but I got a little business." Another man walked in, and a sudden tautness went through Tom. It was Barney Driscoll. "I'm come to get my son," Driscoll announced grimly. He smelled strongly of liquor. "And I've made out charges against you, Binford, for kidnapping." Raw anger rising in him, Tom stood up and shoved his chair out of the way. He glanced at Danny and saw the youngster shrink back, terror in his eyes. "You're not taking him," Tom declared hotly. Then he turned to the sheriff. "Will, you can't give this boy to him. All Driscoll wants is the ranch Frank Summers left. He'll mistreat Danny just like he always did." The lawman sadly shook his head. "Sorry, Tom. He's the boy's daddy, and I got a warrant for you. I gotta take you in." Driscoll smirked. "Maybe you'd like the inheritance for yourself, Binford. Or maybe it's because you were in love with Danny's mother." Tom choked back a hot reply and fought a blinding urge to smash Driscoll's face. He shot a quick glance at Della, but her eyes betrayed nothing. Yarby muttered angrily, "Shut up, Driscoll. Just because you got the law on your side is no excuse for you to blow off that way." Then the officer turned to the girl. "Get the boy's things, Della, and Tom, you'll have to come with us." Fury rose in Tom as he waited. Then he glanced at a shotgun propped up in the nearest corner. He caught Mort Graham's eyes and winked. Moving swiftly, Tom shoved the table forward. Driscoll grunted and buckled as it hit him in the stomach. Tom grabbed up the shotgun. It wasn't loaded, he knew, but neither the sheriff nor Driscoll would want to take a chance. Catching his breath, the lawman grinned. "Might as well sit down, Driscoll. Looks like we'll have a long wait." Face livid with rage, Driscoll exploded. "You'll pay for this, all of you." Della's blue eyes were wide with excitement as she came out and gave the boy his small bag of belongings. Tom handed the shotgun to Della's father and signaled for Danny to follow him. "Dump some food in a sack for us while we saddle up," he yelled back at Della. He grabbed Danny's hand and quickly led the boy to the barn. A moment later, their horses were saddled and the rest of the mounts had been chased off into the pasture. Della came running out with a canteen and a sack full of food. Her eyes glistened as she stopped in front of Tom. "Are you sure this is right?" she asked. "Maybe not, but it's better than letting Driscoll get the boy back," Tom replied. "We'll hole up in that old Nestor dugout on the south side of the ranch. And Della, see if there isn't something Judge Matlock can do." From the house came frenzied sounds of a struggle. Tom quickly kissed Della, lifted Danny up into the saddle, and mounted. Driscoll burst out of the kitchen door, a gun in his hand. Tom slapped Danny's pony on the rump and spurred away. He saw flame spout from Driscoll's gun and heard the buzz of the bullet. The gun spoke again, and Danny gave a startled cry. He dropped his bag and swayed over the saddle horn. Dry-lipped, Tom caught the boy and held him in the saddle as he spurred on toward the protecting line of brush. Panic surged through him as he saw Danny's face whiten and felt warm, sticky blood on the boy's sleeve. He knew the bullet hadn't been meant for the boy, but he swore bitterly against any man who would be so careless with his own son's life. Moments later, in the protection of the thick mesquite, Tom pulled up and dismounted. He lifted the frightened youngster out of the saddle and tore open his sleeve. The bullet had passed through without touching the bone, but Tom knew the boy would soon be sick from shock. When the wound was bandaged, he put Danny back onto the saddle and headed for the dugout. The sun was low in the west when he lifted the weakened lad down again and carried him into the dark, musty old dwelling. Tenderly, he put Danny on a cot. Danny's forehead was hot, and his eyes were a little glazed. Shock had sapped his strength. The anxiety was like drawing rawhide around Tom's heart, and he built a fire to boil some water. The youngster never whimpered as Tom carefully cleansed the wound. It was a long, painful night for Tom as he sat on the edge of the cot, watching the boy's chest in its faint, irregular heave and fall. Time and again he felt the warm forehead and swore softly when he caught himself dozing off. Shortly after dawn, Danny awakened and tried to sit up, but he sank back with a weak cry. "Where's Della?" he asked softly. "Why isn't she here?" Tom gripped the boy's hand. "We'll see her before long," he assured Danny, and felt pleasure when the youngster smiled. Then he took the bandage off. A new fear assailed him. The wound was turning blue. Sick at heart, Tom bandaged the arm again and walked to the low door of the dugout. The boy had to have a doctor, but the minute they showed up in town... Slowly he walked back and looked down at the boy's white face. If they stayed here, the youngster would die. If they went to town, Tom would be shoved into jail and Danny given back to Driscoll. Tom fought the tightness which clutched at his throat. There wasn't any choice. They had to go to town. He turned the paint pony loose and held Danny in front of him on the saddle as they headed for Rocky Wells. It seemed hours before they turned into the crooked, winding road that was the last lap of the way. Sleepiness stung Tom's eyes, but he held grimly onto the boy. They passed the spot where the runaway team had piled up old Frank Summers' wagon. Then the town of Rocky Wells pushed up out of the rolling rangeland. Riding along the dirt street toward the doctor's house, Tom sadly looked down at the white young face which lay against his chest. "This is the end of the line for us as a team, Danny," he thought grimly. Then he carried Danny into the house, and the baldish, gray-bearded doctor examined the boy's arm. "Good thing you brought him in, Tom," the medical man said. "He might have gotten gangrene if he'd stayed in that dugout. You used good sense, son." A few minutes later, Sheriff Will Yarby walked in. "I heard you'd come back, Tom. Guess you know I've got to arrest you," he said apologetically. Tom nodded. "Let's go, Will." Little Danny raised himself up on his good arm. "Tom," he said weakly, "you're not going to leave me, are you?" The heavy-set sheriff looked uncertainly, his face softening. He studiously rubbed the back of his neck. Then he said, "No, sonny, he's not going anyplace." Softly he said to Tom, "I'll leave you with him if you promise not to try running off again." Tom agreed. Will Yarby paused in the doorway. "I'll send Della over right away. I'll have to bring Driscoll over too. Don't you go losing your head." In a few minutes, Della came running in and threw herself into Tom's arms. "Oh, Tom," she cried, "why did you come back? You haven't a chance now." "I had to," he told her quietly. "Danny's hurt." Her face went pale and she stepped quickly to the bed where the boy lay. She took his hand and smiled weakly down at him as the lad opened his eyes. "How bad is it?" she asked the doctor. Tom moved to her and put an arm around her shoulder. The doctor told her the boy would be all right if given good care. Tom felt a warm glow inside as he saw the way she looked down at Danny. She did love him, he was sure. The door swung open and Driscoll stalked in belligerently, followed by Sheriff Yarby and Judge Matlock. Driscoll reeked of whiskey and his bloodshot eyes were full of hatred. "So you brought him back," he snarled. "Try and get that ranch away from me, will you? I'll have you sent to the pen for so long you'll never get out." He turned to the physician and demanded, "Wrap that kid up. I'm taking him out of here." Alarmed, the doctor protested. "He's in no shape to travel. He's got to stay here and rest." Driscoll cursed. "Stay here so they can steal him again, you mean? They think if they can keep the kid, they'll get the ranch. Now bundle him up. I got a buckboard outside." Angrily, Tom stepped toward Driscoll, fist clenched. The sheriff grabbed his arm. "Hold it, Tom. You're under arrest, you know." Judge Matlock reached inside his huge coat and pulled out a document. "Just a minute, all of you. Since there seems to be so much worry about who's to get the ranch," he said, looking coldly at Driscoll, "maybe I'd better read Frank Summers' will again." Della's hands gripped Tom's arm as the judge read aloud. Tom caught the jurist's emphasis on the part which said Judge Matlock was named administrator of the estate. The big man cleared his throat. "Now, in view of the fact that I haven't time to run such a ranch myself, I'll have to appoint someone to manage it for the boy, in a regular foreman's capacity." Driscoll grinned. "That's me. I'm his father." The judge glared at him. "It will be whomever I choose to name. A few minutes ago you were willing to risk the boy's life to carry him away from here, to make sure of getting the ranch. That shows you have no interest in the lad's own welfare. I know someone else who loves the boy, though, loves him enough to risk losing everything he has to save the youngster's life." The judge turned to Tom. "Tom, I'm appointing you to manage Frank Summers' estate." Tom squeezed Della's hands and looked happily at Danny. "It's a trick," bawled Driscoll, his face crimson. "You're trying to cheat me out of what's mine, but it won't work." In a flash, he reached under his coat and snaked out a six-gun. "As long as you don't have the kid, you can't take the ranch, and the brat's going with me." His bloodshot eyes were ablaze, and his gun hand trembled dangerously from the effects of his drinking. Keeping everyone covered, he stepped back to the bed. Danny whimpered with pain as his father picked him up. "The man is drunk, crazy mad," Tom breathed, a million fires blazing within him. Driscoll heaved the youngster onto the buckboard seat. Climbing up, he flipped the reins, and the team surged forward. The buckboard veered crazily and skidded around a corner on two wheels. "He doesn't even know where he's going," Tom shouted excitedly. "He's headed for the road that killed Frank Summers." His heart thumping, Tom dashed for his horse, swung into the saddle, and spurred after Driscoll. Wind whipped in his face as he slowly closed up the distance between him and the buckboard. Then Driscoll was on the treacherous, crooked road. The buckboard bounced, skidded, and cut corners. A prayer was on Tom's lips as he watched Driscoll whipping the team for even more speed. He had to get Danny off that buckboard before Driscoll killed them both. Bending low over the saddle horn, he spurred again and again. Dust boiling up in the bouncing vehicle stung his eyes. Driscoll started shooting at him. Heart pounding dully, Tom heard the bullets zip by. Then the gun was empty, and Driscoll hurled it back at him. Tom closed in and finally pulled up alongside the racing buckboard. As he reached out to grab Danny off the seat, Driscoll cracked a whip at him. Tom smothered a cry of pain as the lash burned across his shoulders. Driscoll cursed and drew back for another swing. Quickly, Tom caught Danny and pulled him off the buckboard. Face livid with fury, Driscoll tried to jerk the racing team around. They turned sharply. There was the rending, crushing sound of splintering wood as the buckboard's coupling pole snapped. The front wheels jerked loose, and the vehicle seemed to stand on its side a second. Driscoll's cry was cut short as the buckboard heaved over and crashed down on him. Then there was only the sound of the spinning rear wheels and the panicked team galloping away. Danny began to cry. Tom carefully swung down and put the lad on the ground. Dropping his reins, he trotted over to the wrecked buckboard, but there wasn't any use. It had fallen on Driscoll before his body had straightened out. His neck was broken. His mouth dry from the choking dust, Tom turned and walked slowly back to the sobbing boy. He put his hands on Danny's thin shoulders and turned the lad around to face the back trail. A billowing cloud of dust showed where another buckboard was moving rapidly toward them. "Everything'll be all right, Danny," Tom spoke gently, leading the boy forward. "We're going home to your new mother." And that was Colt Size by Elmer Kelton. And now we'll read an Elmer Kelton story entitled No Epitaph for Me. This also deals with a young boy, or at least the memories of a young boy. On the off side of the hill, two of the three shivering riders swung down from their saddles. Stiff-fingered, they tied their split leather reins to winter-bared mesquite limbs swaying in the chill morning wind. Hunching over against the cold, they trudged up the hill. The third man stayed in the saddle. He was bent low over the saddle horn, clutching with a gloved hand the dried crimson blotch that spread down from the shoulder of his thick woolen coat. His pinched young face was almost blue. His struggle against pain had left ugly tooth marks on his lower lip. Reaching the top of the hill, Clay Forehand crouched low. He glanced a moment at the heavy gray clouds and grunted in satisfaction. There was a smell of rain in the air, freezing rain that would chill to the bone, but it would wash out tracks. Zack Bratcher crawled up behind him. "See them anywheres? They coming on?" The wind was blowing straight down from the wide-open plains of the Texas Panhandle. Forehand blinked the windbite from his eyes and peered anxiously over the back trail. "There's a little speck down there. Can't tell if it's moving or not." Awkwardly, because of the cold, he reached into his sheep-lined coat and pulled out a six-shooter. He slipped it into the crotch of a stout mesquite near the ground, where the wind couldn't move it. He worked it around until the sights were aligned on the speck. Blinking again, he concentrated on the front sight. The spot moved slowly from the top of the sight and off to the left. "They're heading up the river," he said. Zack Bratcher chuckled, a chuckle that came from deep in his thick throat. A grin showed stained teeth through the black stubble that covered his wolfish face. "Then we've shook them, by God. It took us 2 days, but we've shook them." Clay grunted. "If they don't circle back and cut our sign before it rains. Now let's put some more miles behind us so we can find shelter for Alan." He trotted down the hill, enjoying briefly the warm tingling of blood circulating through his saddle-stiffened legs. He wasn't a big man, this Clay Forehand, but though he was hardly more than 30, he already had a way of carrying himself, a stern set to his stubbled jaw that made men walk around him. Untying his own horse, Clay led him up beside the wounded man's mount. "How you making it, boy?" Alan Forehand swayed over the horn. He mumbled an unintelligible answer through his chattering teeth. Attempting a show of cheerfulness, Clay rested his hand on his brother's knee. "Hang on, boy. We'll be finding you a house and a warm bed directly." But, he pondered darkly as he swung into the cold saddle, it had better not be too long. The jogging ride might start the wound bleeding again. Alan had spilled too much blood already, this side of the San Angelo bank. The rain started, as he had hoped. First it fell in scattered droplets, cold as ice. Then it was a deluge, spilling off the flattened broad brim of his hat, soaking his pants legs and filling his boots, working its chill through to the marrow. But muddy brown rivulets poured off the hillsides, taking all tracks with them. Long, cold, sodden hours added up the miles, but Alan was falling back. Clay slowed down to stay beside him. Irritably, Bratcher drew rein and pulled around to face them. "Come on, come on, let's get moving." Warmth rose on the back of Clay's neck. "The kid's doing the best he can. You keep your mouth shut." Bratcher's muddy eyes glowered. He chewed his thick lips. "The kid didn't have any business being with us in the first place. If he hadn't been so chicken-hearted, he wouldn't have got shot." Clay kept hold of the boy's arm, steadying him as they rode. "He can't kill people the way you can, Zack, like they was rabbits. Even when he saw the button aim the six-shooter at him, he couldn't make himself kill a youngster like that." Zack grunted. "There wasn't nothing kept me from shooting." Clay swallowed down a hard taste that came to his mouth. The picture was still sharp in his mind. Zack Bratcher swinging his gun down into the horrified button's face after Alan had been hit. The face had all but disappeared. Zack squinted his eyes and frowned. "Now, if you don't hurry that kid up a little, I'm taking my share of the money and riding on." A threat of real anger rode up and down Clay's throat. He wanted to say, "Go on and be damned to you." There'd come a time maybe when he would, but now he might need Bratcher. It wasn't long until they pushed out of a mesquite thicket at the head of a draw and saw the little cow camp snuggled against the long, rocky foot of a tabletop hill. Brownish smoke trailed the wind as it curled out of a tin chimney that shoved crookedly up from the roof of a small rock house near the hill base. Relief warmed Clay. Tightly he gripped his brother's shivering arm. "Come on, boy, we've found you a bed." Zack Bratcher held up his big, hairy hand. "You hold up a minute, Clay. We was careful to keep our faces covered when we hit that bank. When we pull out of this place, we can't leave anybody alive to be describing us and getting us identified. You got that?" Clay looked at his brother's pale, drawn face and nodded immediately. "Sure, sure, we won't leave anybody. Now let's get to that house." A little brown dog trotted out to meet them. He barked loudly, then dashed in to nip at the ankles of Zack's skittish horse. Cursing, Bratcher jerked at the reins and pulled out his pistol. "Put that gun up, Zack," Clay said stiffly. "We need their help, and killing their dog ain't going to make them friendly." Muttering, Bratcher holstered the gun. The solid plank door of the rock house swung inward, and a young woman stood in the doorway. She was wiping bread dough off her hands onto an apron of cotton sacking. She gazed open-mouthed at Alan, who was swaying in the saddle. "We got a man hurt here," Clay said. "We got to get him to bed." She paled. She had an attractive face, Clay noted involuntarily. With the care town girls could give it, it could have been a pretty face. Bring him on in," she said uncertainly, gripping the door edge a little fearfully. To Clay, watchfulness was ingrained, the result of years of riding and looking back. As the pleasant wood fire warmth of the one-room house enveloped him, his sweeping gaze took in every corner. One bed, a big iron kitchen stove with dry mesquite wood piled high in a box behind it. Pantry in one corner, table and cabinet of rough pine lumber, quirt, rope, and battered hat hanging on pegs stuck in the plaster of the rock wall. Poor as sheepherders, he thought disinterestedly, but snug and comfortable, a man could bet his boots. Clay put his brother down on the one bed. "Boil us some water and get us some clean cloth for a bandage," he ordered the woman. Quickly, she poured a bucketful of water into a pan and set it on top of the big iron cook stove. She shoved some more wood into the fire. Then she picked up the bucket and started for the door. Bratcher stepped in front of her and caught her roughly. "Where do you think you're going?" She trembled. Her voice shook. "Just to get some water out of the well." Bratcher took the bucket out of her hand. "I'll get it. You stay here." Carefully, Clay took the heavy coat off of Alan. He unstrapped the boy's gun, looked for a place to put it, then shoved it far under the bed. He tried to take off the shirt, but the dried blood had stuck to the wound. He waited impatiently while the water heated, then gingerly, trying to keep from scalding the boy, he soaked the dried blood and pulled the shirt away. Looking at the raw wound, he swallowed hard. A deep blue color had already spread far outward from the bullet hole. The smell of rotting flesh pinched Clay's nostrils, made him pull his head away. He tried to shut his ears to his brother's ragged breathing. He blinked at the stinging in his eyes. Not a chance in 100 now. Dazedly, he went on trying to cleanse the wound, but his hands shook. He felt the woman's arm brush against his. She took the wet cloth from him. "You'd better let me do it," she said. She seemed to have found her voice again. With only a little hesitation, she finished cleaning the wound. She started putting on a bandage. Watching her, Clay noted that her lips were drawn thin and pale as she worked, but her fingers were sure. He noted a slight trembling in her slender throat. He let his gaze settle on her figure, fully rounded down to where it was lost in the fullness of a skirt that trailed the floor. "What's your name?" he asked her. "Who lives here?" "I'm Mary Sloan. There's just my husband and me. He's out looking at the cattle." "When's he coming in?" "For supper, any time now. Maybe 10 minutes, maybe an hour." Zack Bratcher shoved through the door and set down the bucket. He took off his hat and shook the water from it. "I put the horses out there in a corral and gave them a little of the feed I found. They'll be handy in case we gotta leave." He looked toward the unconscious boy. Wish he'd hurry up and do whatever he's going to, so we could shove on. Clay jumped to his feet, face hot, fists clenched. He caught himself and tried to force down the hatred that edged through him. Someday, Zach, he thought, you and me'll find out which one is fastest, but it won't be today. Clay sat back down on the edge of Alan's bed and anxiously watched the boy's face. After a while, he became conscious of Zach seated on a hide-bottomed chair in a corner, his gaze following the woman as she worked at the stove. A hunger began to look out of those muddy eyes. The woman walked over next to Zach and reached up to get a can of coffee down from a shelf. Zach shoved up from the chair and grabbed her. He crushed her body to his and eagerly sought her mouth with his thick, stubble-rimmed lips. She cried out in fear and anger. Clay jumped up. He grabbed Zach's big arm and pulled it away from the woman. She jerked out of Bratcher's grasp. Choking, she grabbed a quirt from a peg on the wall and lashed it across the outlaw's dark face, once, twice, and a third time. Clay shoved Bratcher back into the chair so hard that the man's head bumped against the rock wall. He wrested the quirt from the woman's hand. "Get this through your thick head, Zach," he roared. "We want this woman's help with Alan. That's all we want from her. You got that?" Bratcher rubbed his hairy hand across his face and felt the raw welts rising beneath the black beard. There was poison in his eyes. "All right, you wench," he gritted. "When we leave here, you'll pay for that." "Shut up, Zach," Clay snapped, but he saw sudden dread wash across the woman's face. Clay jerked his head up. From over the drumming of the rain on the roof, he thought he heard a hello. He listened intently. It came again from up around the foot of the hill. "Jim!" the woman gasped. She ran toward the door. Clay caught her. "Your husband?" She nodded in fear. Gun in his hand, Clay took position by the small, many-sectioned window to watch the rider coming in through the rain. "Open the door so he can see you," he commanded, "but don't let on there's anything wrong." The tall young horseman reined up 30 yards in front of the house. His leather chaps flapping, he swung down and yelled a greeting as his wife opened the door. Then she screamed, "Keep away, Jim! For God's sake, run!" She darted out the door and into the rain. Catching a sharp breath, Clay bounded after her. He caught her and jerked her roughly to a stop. Instead of running away, the cowboy hurried toward them, anger in his face. He stopped short as Clay brought up the gun. "What is this, anyhow?" he asked quickly. Clay noted with satisfaction that the puncher wasn't packing a six-shooter. He let the woman run to her husband and throw her arms around him, sobbing. "You better come on in," Clay said. Inside, out of the rain, the young woman clung tightly to her husband. Zach was grumbling. "If it had been me, I'd have shot both of them out there." Clay flicked Zach a hard glance that told him to shut up. Looking at the woman and not knowing why, he felt something like pride rising in him. She had courage, that one did. He found himself envying the cowboy. Clay had never known a woman who would risk a bullet in the back for him. Some of the kind he had been around would have put a bullet in his back if they thought there was money enough in his pockets to make it worthwhile. "You'll both be all right as long as you don't go acting foolish," he told the couple. "Now I think we need some supper." Clay managed to get a little broth down Alan's throat, but Alan never regained consciousness enough to eat. Clay could feel the fever rising in the boy. Cautiously, he looked under the bandage. The blue was spreading. "What about our milk cow?" Jim Sloan asked after supper. "We've got to go milk her, or her bag'll spoil." Clay looked at Zach. It wouldn't do to take Sloan out and leave the woman alone with Zach. It wouldn't do to leave Sloan with Zach, either. Bratcher's gun hand was too itchy today. So Clay followed both the Sloans out toward the cow pen and left Zach to watch Alan. Clay felt a strong respect growing for Sloan as he looked at the young ranchman's corrals. Half the fences were made of mesquite limbs and trunks, the rest were piled rocks. This far from town and this far from timber, plank corrals were too expensive, but the rock was here. All it took was labor. Sloan had put in plenty of that. Clay thought unpleasantly of his father. All Pa had ever worked at was meanness. While Jim Sloan unsaddled his horse, the woman turned a big heifer calf in with the milk cow. She'd left her a few minutes, then put a short rope around her neck and led her off to a smaller pen. Jim started milking. "That heifer calf's about big enough to butcher," Clay remarked as the woman returned with the short rope. She shook her head. "Oh, no, we're saving her for a cow. When our baby gets here, we'll need more milk." Clay's eyes opened a little wider. "Baby?" She nodded. "It's due in the spring." He glanced at Jim Sloan. He caught the pride in the cowboy's eyes. Clay wondered, and unwelcome memories crowded to his mind, memories of his boyhood. His parents had had a deep hatred for each other. They'd never really wanted him. It had been a long time ago. But sometimes, even yet in nightmare, Clay could imagine Pa was hiding him with a razor strap, taking it out on the boy for something the old woman had said. Clay had saddled an old plow horse in the dead of night and headed west before there was any fuzz on his face. He'd never gone back but once, years later. He'd found Pa and the old woman treating Alan like they had treated him. Clay stole his brother away and took to the rough country with him. Anything was better for the kid than staying with the folks, he thought. Now Alan was dying an outlaw's death, and Clay wondered. He let his eyes brood on Jim and Mary Sloan. Things would be different with their baby. These folks weren't like Pa and the old woman. Trouble was, the baby would never be born. Like Zack had said, when they pulled out of here, they couldn't afford to leave anyone behind them. After nightfall, the rain drummed intermittently on the roof. Alan's breathing became more labored. Fever burned in his face. In delirium, he turned his head from one side to the other, mumbling incoherently. Clay's throat grew tight and his pulse quickened. Wasn't there something somebody could do for the boy? Mary Sloan did all she could. She put cool cloths over the boy's burning forehead. She tried to keep the wound clean. By midnight, she was dragging her feet. Jim Sloan stood quietly behind her, helping wherever he could. Zack Bratcher had taken a couple of quilts and thrown them on the floor in another corner. Once in a while, he would turn over, grumbling. After midnight, Clay let the Sloans spread blankets on the floor and get some sleep. He sat up alone with Alan, keeping the fire going, watching the fever mount, feeling the life ebb lower. At daylight, all were up again. Zack was grouching about being hungry and muttering that Mary Sloan had damn well better get to work at the stove if she knew what was good for her. But first she came over to the bedside and looked at Alan. Clay swallowed and blinked his eyes that burned from worry and anguish and lack of sleep. "He hasn't got a chance," he thought woodenly. "It's just a question of time." Zack was rummaging around in the little pantry next to the cabinet. "I'm starved plumb to death. Where's the beef?" Mary Sloan said, "We used the last of it for supper." Zack glared at her, mumbling in his beard. He stomped outside and shoved the door shut behind him. While Clay sat on the edge of the bed, running his fingers through his hair and blinking back the sleep from his eyes, Mary Sloan re-cleansed Alan's wound. Her face paled as she worked. "She knows it too," Clay thought bleakly. "The kid hasn't got long to go." Presently, Zack came back in, hugging a heavy hindquarter of fresh, butchered beef. "Now, woman," he growled, "we'll have steak for breakfast." Mary Sloan's slender hand went up to her pale mouth. Her eyes widened. "Our calf," she cried. "You butchered the calf we were saving for our baby." Angrily, she stepped toward him. Quickly, Jim Sloan grabbed her. "Stop it, Mary. Don't be a fool. He'd shoot you for no reason at all." She sobbed. "It was our baby's heifer, our baby's." Zack grunted, "Shut up and start cooking. When we leave here, you won't be worried about calves or babies or anything else." Clay stood up angrily. "Damn you, Zack. Can't you keep that blabbing mouth of yours shut?" Mary Sloan choked. "Jim, they're going to kill us." Sloan's face turned a shade whiter. He gripped his wife's shoulders. "Get hold of yourself, Mary," he said in a moment. "I'll put some wood in the stove and we'll get breakfast." Sloan went to the wood box and took out a couple of big sticks of dry mesquite. Zack hovered over the stove, an expectant grin on his whiskered face as he looked at the quarter of beef. Sloan shoved the wood in the stove and settled the coals with a long poker. Suddenly he swung the poker up and brought it down across Bratcher's skull. The gunman fell heavily to the floor. "Get out, Mary!" Sloan yelled. "Run!" The woman dashed in desperation toward the door. Clay was on his feet and grabbing at his gun. Sloan rushed him, the poker swung back over his shoulder. He brought it down just as Clay pulled up his gun hand. The poker struck the bone of the wrist, and sharp pain lanced through Clay. The gun clattered to the floor. Throwing his weight against Sloan, Clay managed to knock the cowboy off balance and tumble him backward. In an instant, Clay scooped up the fallen gun with his left hand and swung it at Sloan's head. The cowboy went limp. His wrist burning like fire, Clay jumped to the door and shoved outside. Mary Sloan was running for the barn. Her long skirts were tripping her, and the deep mud was slowing her down. Clay caught up with her and grabbed her arm. She struggled a moment, then gave up. All hope in her eyes slowly died. Getting his breath back, Clay said flatly, "Can't say as I blame you for trying, but it was foolish." The feel of her soft, slender arm under the heavy grip of his left hand sent a peculiar but pleasant tingle through him. Not hard to see why Sloan had married her. For a moment he felt an impulse to pull her to him, to know the thrill of her body against his own. But that was the way Zack Brasher did things. Clay fought down the urge and led her back toward the little rock house. Jim Sloan was struggling to pull himself up off the floor. With a sharp cry, Mary Sloan ran to him. She dipped a cloth in cool water and tenderly washed his face. As he came around, she put her cheek to his and hugged him tightly. Watching them, Clay swallowed. Real folks, these two. If Pa and the old woman could have been that way. Zack Brasher was on his hands and knees, straining to get to his feet. Once up, he steadied himself on the stove's guardrail. He blinked his muddy eyes. Memory came back to him, and he reached shakily for his gun. Clay's voice had the edge of a whipsaw. "You put that gun up, Zack." Brasher's brownish eyes were hard as rock. His hand wavered only slightly. Clay could feel his heartbeat quicken. He let his own hand ease down toward his gun. Alan's feverish voice made Clay whirl around. The boy was thrashing about deliriously. Heart in his throat, Clay caught the boy's arms and pushed him back down onto the bed. Alan struggled another moment. He relaxed then, and the heavy breathing stopped. Unbelievingly, Clay shook Alan, cried for him to breathe again. He was suddenly caught up in a roaring black storm. He cursed himself. He cursed the San Angelo Bank. He cursed Pa and the old woman. But there was no use. It was over. After a bit, Clay made himself look at the other people. He could see dread in Mary Sloan's eyes, and pity, too. Zack Brasher's voice was brittle. "Well, now that it's all done, we better be riding." Woodenly, Clay shook his head. "No, not yet. I want to bury him first." The rain had stopped. They wrapped Alan in a patchwork quilt and carried him 300 yards from the house, at the foot of the long hill. There Jim Sloan dug a grave, and Alan Forehand was laid to rest. Sloan had brought along a short plank. As Clay was finishing up filling the grave and noticing dully the growing stiffness of his wrist, Sloan took out a pocket knife and began to carve on the wood. "What's that for?" Clay asked abruptly, laying down the shovel. Sloan looked up in surprise. "A headboard. You want to mark the grave, don't you?" Clay jerked the board out of Sloan's hands and hurled it away across the rocky slope. "No!" he cried. "You think I want people saying here's the grave of Alan Forehand, shot down while robbing the San Angelo Bank?" He tried desperately to keep his voice from breaking. "It wasn't the kid's fault he ended up like this. I caused it. Me and Pa and my old woman. It's better for us to leave him here without a trace than to bury him with an outlaw marker over his head." Sloan didn't argue. Quietly, he picked up the shovel and finished filling the grave. Cooling a little, Clay felt strangely grateful. The cowboy had only wanted to help. The job done, the group started back toward the little rock house. Jim and Mary Sloan walked in the lead, the cowboy holding his arm around his wife's shoulder. Clay was next, stumbling along, his head down, his eyes blurred. Behind him stalked Zack Brasher, itchy hands rubbing the butt of his six-gun. As they reached the house, Bratcher's voice called out harshly, "Poison is a snake. Turn around, you Sloanes." Clay blinked hard and raised his head. The Sloanes had stopped. They had their arms around one another, waiting for Bratcher to squeeze the trigger. There was fear in their faces, all right, but they weren't running and they weren't begging. They were staying together right to the end. A sudden thought struck Clay. Where might Alan be right now if he had had folks like these instead of Paul and the old woman? In his mind, he could see again Mary Sloan working until she was dead on her feet, trying to ease Alan's pain. He thought on Pa's shiftlessness and on Jim Sloan's rock house and rock corrals. He heard again the cursing and the bickering of Pa and the old woman, and he looked at the young couple in each other's arms. Before he realized it, he had his hand on his gun. His wrist was still stiff. "Keep your gun in your holster, Zack," he said sharply. "They're not going to die." Bratcher's muddy eyes cut furiously to Clay's. "The deal was that we left nobody alive. You backing down on that, Clay?" Clay's voice was firm. "I'm saying we owe more than we can pay them. We're leaving them alone." Bratcher snarled. "Owe them nothing but two slugs. I'm paying that debt if I've got to cut you down first, Clay." The wolfish look came to his face. "If I beat you, I'll be three times as rich as I was yesterday, and I'll never again have to listen to you tell me what to do." Clay could feel his heartbeat quicken. For a long time he had known this would come if he stayed with Zack too long. Now here it was. The butt of the gun under his hand was slick with cold sweat. He was aware of the Sloanes moving cautiously toward the door of the house. Then he saw that sudden warning in Bratcher's eyes a split second before the outlaw's hand jerked upward with the pistol. Clay pulled his own gun. Sharp pain stabbed through his wrist, slowed his draw. "The lick from that damned poker," he thought desperately. Bratcher's first slug spun him half around. He thought he heard a door slam. Falling, he squeezed off a wild shot at Bratcher and knew it had missed. Another slug ripped into him. Flames roared through him. His head reeled. The gun slipped from his stiffened fingers. He tried to push himself up from the ground and felt cold mud ooze around his hands. He raised his head painfully and blinked away the haze. Bratcher was stepping cautiously toward him. The whole scene was swaying back and forth. Bratcher leveled the gun again. Clay tried to make himself search for his fallen pistol, but he could do nothing. A shot echoed in his ears. The thought came to him that Zack had missed. He blinked again and saw Bratcher sprawled out face down in the mud. Clay's arms gave way under him. He could feel the wet ground under his whiskered cheek. Someone caught hold of his shoulder, turned him over onto his back. It was Jim Sloan. Mary Sloan stood over him. You shot Jack," Clay managed to say to Jim. "But where'd you find a gun?" It was Mary Sloan who spoke. "It was Alan's gun. When you brought him in, you pitched it under the bed. You forgot to take it out." Now it was Jim Sloan who was speaking. "We're grateful to you, Forehand. We wish there was something we could do." Weakly, Clay shook his head. No, there wasn't anything anybody could do now. "There's one thing," he said painfully. "When that baby comes, you treat him right. Give him a chance. He won't end up like the Forehands." And so it was that another grave joined Alan's there at the foot of the rocky hill. Like the first one, it was left without a marker. But Clay and Alan Forehand were to have a monument just the same, a living one. The spring rains had come and the grass had risen green when Jim Sloan hitched the team to the wagon and took Mary down the long, dim trail to town. When he brought her back a few weeks later, there was someone new in the wagon, wrapped in tiny blankets and carried in its mother's lap. They named him Clay Alan Sloan. And thus concludes Elmer Kelton's No Epitaph for Me. I mentioned that we might have a little time left, and we do. Here is a very brief selection entitled The Infamous Band at Queens by Gary McCarthy. In the 1870s, Bell Star was outrageously described by a dime novelist in this way. "Of all the women of the Cleopatra type, since the days of the Egyptian queen herself, The universe has produced none more remarkable than Belle Starr, the Bandit Queen, more amorous than Mark Antony's mistress, more relentless than a pharaoh's daughter, and braver than Joan of Arc. This flowery tribute differs markedly from the descriptions that Belle applied to herself when she said, "I regard myself as a woman who has seen much of life." Belle might just as well have added "hard" before the word life. Belle Starr was born Myra Belle Shirley in 1848 on her father's 800-acre farm near Carthage, Missouri. Little is known about her parents except that her father was reported to have been from an aristocratic Virginia family. This is partially supported by the fact that Belle received an excellent upbringing and education at a private academy where she studied Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. But somewhere in her childhood, sweet, innocent little Myra became tough and absolutely ruthless Belle. Part of her dramatic metamorphosis can be attributed to the fact that Belle found herself embroiled in bloody times as guerrilla warfare erupted over the issue of whether or not Kansas was to be admitted to the Union as a free or a slave state. Her brother was shot down and her father lost everything in the turmoil and moved his family to present-day Dallas, Texas. In 1866, the James and Younger brothers robbed their first bank in Liberty, Texas, and fled south with $6,000 in cash and bonds. Cole Younger met the 18-year-old Belle, and she fell wildly in love with him, a love that she would later proclaim never diminished, although she took many lovers. After her passionate affair with Cole Younger, Belle gave birth to a daughter she named Pearl. It wasn't long at all before she was jilted by the handsome Cole Younger, but Belle was now permanently hooked on the outlaw life. Within months, Belle took up with a man named Jim Reed, a noted bank and train robber. With the law close behind, the Reeds moved to California. But the California gold rush was long since over, and the Reeds found life out west difficult, so they returned to central Texas, where they began to rustle horses and cattle. There is some evidence to suggest that Belle and her man tortured an old Creek Indian until he revealed where he had hidden his lifetime savings. Whether or not this is true, it typifies the hard natures of Belle and Jim Reed, who both gained notorious reputations. Enterprising dime novelists cashed in on that notoriety, and Belle was soon known throughout our American West as the Bandit Queen. Belle Starr, who never considered herself especially physically attractive, gloried in her new celebrity. She dressed up in velvet gowns, plumed hats, white silk blouses, and shiny black boots. When she galloped into town on her flashy black mare, Venus, she was quite a spectacle, with a pearl-handled colt strapped around her hips. Belle's language was salty, to put it mildly, and she made wonderful newspaper copy. Soon, legends began to sprout about all manner of exploits that she and her outlaw husband were involved in, most of them wildly fictionalized. That changed, however, when Jim Reed was gunned down in 1874 by a member of his own outlaw gang. Belle Starr left her daughter Pearl and infant son with her mother and set out to enhance her flamboyant reputation. From 1875 to 1880, she was the undisputed leader of a band of horse and cattle thieves who plagued the country around the Nations, which is a huge patch of reservation land in eastern Oklahoma. An Indian named Blue Duck became her constant companion and lover until he was replaced by a tall, dignified Cherokee by the name of Sam Starr. Belle was 28. Her new man was only a few years older. For a while, the pair lived peaceably on Starr's small farm near the Canadian River. But times were hard, and Belle soon tired of reservation living. Arrested for stealing horses, she and Sam were brought before the famous hanging judge, Isaac Parker. The pretrial atmosphere was carnival-like. Belle Starr was besieged by newspaper reporters, and she was not above lavishly embellishing her escapades as the Bandit Queen. For perhaps the first and only time in his harsh and unbending career as a federal judge, Isaac Parker was lenient, and Belle and her husband received only short prison sentences. Both Belle and Sam Starr were model prisoners, but they certainly were not reformed. Sam was killed only a few years later by an Indian deputy whom he had shot and wounded in a drunken rage. Belle, once again a widow, took up with a young Creek Indian named Jim July. Like all her men, Jim had larceny in his heart and quickly got into trouble with the law. In 1889, Belle convinced Jim July that the government had no proof against him that would stand up in court, so July agreed to surrender to the authorities. Belle accompanied him halfway to Fort Smith, Arkansas, where Judge Parker still presided. On February 3, 1899, just 2 days before her 41st birthday, while riding home from a friend's house in Eufaula, Oklahoma, she was ambushed and shot dead. No one was ever arrested for the murder of Belle Starr, and historians today still dispute who murdered the Bandit Queen. But the story is not quite over. Her daughter, Pearl, hired a stonecutter to carve an image of Belle's beloved mare, Venus, along with the epitaph, "Shed not for her the bitter tear, nor give the heart to vain regret. This but the casket that lies here. The gem that fills it sparkles yet." Exactly 10 years later, another Pearl, whose last name was Hart, teamed up with Joe Boot and robbed a stagecoach near Globe, Arizona. They reaped $431 and a place in history as having committed the very last stagecoach robbery in the West. Unfortunately, they got lost in the vast Mojave Desert trying to escape and almost died before a posse rescued them. Pearl was sentenced to a 5-year prison sentence at the dreaded Yuma Territorial Prison. For several years after her parole, Pearl made a comfortable living off a lecture tour where she was regarded as a curiosity and celebrity. A short time later, Pearl vanished into historical obscurity, the last of the Bandit Queens. We can only hope that she did not rob or shoot too many innocent people during the remainder of her mysterious life's journey. And that was The Infamous Bandit Queens by Gary McCarthy. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klinger, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and winded day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.